Well, we are glad to see you. We do appreciate so much this audience that's gathered. It's been a pleasure for me to be here this week. And the services that we've had so far, starting yesterday, it's been a real joy to sing with you and to pray with you. I appreciate the prayer and to think with you, study with you from the Word of God. I certainly appreciate the remarks that were made in the prayer on my behalf, and I appreciate those that were made in reference to those who are the young people here, those gathered today. There's a good core of young folks here, and I want to say something in particular this afternoon that I hope will be an encouragement to you. You are aware of the fact that there are enemies that do indeed desire to destroy you. There's a lot of support in this room, but I'm going to tell you, the devil is after you. He wants to destroy you in any number of ways, and one of the things he wants to do is to take away your purity. It'll be up to you to find the strength in Christ to keep yourself pure. I found a book in a local used bookstore, and the title was so offensive to me that I decided it was worth 98 cents just to get it off the shelf and get it out of circulation. Once in a while I'll do that. Listen to the title of this book. This is a book published in America. How to Survive Your Boyfriend's Divorce. Let that rattle around for a minute. How to Survive Your Boyfriend's Divorce. And the subtitle is, Loving Your Separated Man Without Losing Your Mind. Hard to lose what you don't have. How to Survive Your Boyfriend's Divorce. You know, I don't know. I wonder if that book could have been published 40 years ago or 50 years ago without riding in the streets. I have an idea that it's a fair statement, that things certainly have changed. Our moral standards have changed. I don't think that's news to anybody here. This is an article that's actually a few years old. It was a fellow from the Dallas Morning News, and it was reprinted in another paper. Maybe it's appropriate we might mention this article today. The title of the article, the headline is, There May Come a Time When We Don't Celebrate Father's Day. And to spare you reading the whole article, the point that the man makes is that the number of homes in which a father is not present doing his work, taking responsibility for his own children, is amazing. Only 6% of black children born in 1980 will grow up in families with both parents present. 6%. And you can look at, you know, you can break up the statistics in terms of different groups and so on. They're all bad and getting worse. Another article that I saw more recently, and I don't believe this is any coincidence. The headline on this article reads, One in four teen girls has an STD, which is an acronym for sexually transmitted disease. One in four? Really? Well, again, they break those statistics down, some in certain segments of society more than others, but when you look at it overall, 26% overall. And I won't read the article, but there was one point made in the article that I thought was amazing, in addition to what I just told you. They talked to a woman named Nora Gelfrin, who is identified as someone who works with teens and runs some kind of sex education website. And she said, quote, "Those numbers are alarming." And then she went on to say, "But sexuality is still a very taboo subject in our society." Really? On what planet particularly are you talking about? I can't turn on the television without having it thrown in my face. You can't watch a commercial. We're still trying to blame the outrageous numbers and the outrageous behavior. We're not talking enough about sex. Really? I have an idea that the problem is not that we don't hear enough about it. It's that we don't hear the right thing. That we don't believe what is true anymore. We've thrown out all the restraints. You know, we're talking about liberation. You know, is it liberation to go 190 miles an hour down a dead-end road without a seatbelt on? That's liberation. We got it. But I'll tell you this, and you know it so also. This is not new. When you look at the New Testament, and we read tonight already together, from 1 Corinthians chapter 6, outrageous sexual behavior, low moral standards in society, is a problem that is not new. It may be worse in our society than it used to be, but it's not something Christians have not had to deal with before. And it's not something the gospel cannot overcome. I've read, I don't know how much doctor put in this, but different sources would have suggested that the morals of Corinth were so low and so well known. One fellow said that in ancient plays, if you wanted to show a Corinthian, all you had to do is have him stumble across the stage acting like he was drunk, and people would think, well, that's somebody from Corinth. The Corinthian eyes was a term that was coined to describe someone who had been corrupted morally. That may well be true, but I know this. I know that the gospel was planted in Corinth. And in the passage we read earlier in 1 Corinthians chapter 6, there are a couple of points that Paul made a long time ago that we need today. What are the things that Paul said in this passage? Well, let's start with verse 9 again, if we might. "Do you not know that the unrighteous shall not inherit the kingdom of God? Do not be deceived. Neither fornicators, nor idolaters, nor adulterers, nor homosexuals, nor sodomites, nor thieves, nor covetous, nor drunkards, nor revilers, nor extortioners shall inherit the kingdom of God. And of such were some of you, but you were washed, you were sanctified, and you were justified." In this passage, Paul describes and condemns certain sexual behaviors. And you as Bible students have no doubt noticed how many times when you look at the list of sins, he begins with these sins. They were common in the ancient world as they're common today. One thing he tells me, and it's a message of hope, and that is even those who have been caught up in these sins can be forgiven. Some of the Corinthians, before they came to Christ, had been guilty of these very sins. But they have been washed, and they have been sanctified, and they've been justified. Now there's no doubt that in being washed and sanctified and justified, they've left them behind. If we just flip over quickly to a passage like Colossians chapter 3, there's no question about the fact that Christianity has always demanded that people put sin to death. Put to death your members upon the earth. Fornication. This is Colossians 3:5. Fornication, uncleanness, passion, evil desires, covetousness, which is idolatry. You once, verse 7, walked in these. You once lived in them. But you must now put them off. Put them to death. I have no doubt that the Corinthians, those who Paul is referring to, who are now children of God and saints of God, had done that very thing. It tells me that people can be forgiven. And I think that's an important point to make before we go further. God is gracious. And God is forgiving. And people don't have to live in guilt. They can find forgiveness. And we're all thankful for that. But on the other hand,
There's no way that we might buy into the worldly idea that it's just easier to get forgiveness than get permission. That's the devil talking if I've ever heard. And I do believe that God forgives. But I believe there is a world of difference between those who find forgiveness and those who have been wise enough to heed the counsel of God and not fall into sin's trap. I got a fellow that I appreciate very much. He's a bachelor, and he's a servant of God. Before I knew him, he had lived a life that was corrupt. And he told me, we got to know each other and become very close friends. He said, "You know, when I came back to the Lord, I knew better what I was doing when I did that. But I came back, and I meant it. And I've never looked back." But he said, for a while there would still be some of these women that I used to know. And they would call me. They didn't know that the fellow they were looking for didn't exist anymore. I didn't have any trouble telling those women, you know, that's just not me anymore. But every time I had a call like that, it just opened up all the wounds again and reminded me of all the time I wasted and all the shame I brought on myself and on my name. We got to live with regrets. Some of them come in the form of mental anguish. Some of them come in the form of disease. But I'll tell you, it's there. And it lives with you. I believe the Bible teaches forgiveness, but I believe it also teaches that we'll be certainly wise if we avoid the regret to begin with. And in this passage, Paul makes it plain that it is absolutely inconsistent to claim to be a child of God and to live a life of moral corruption, of sexual impurity. You know, that's news in the world in which we live. My daughter worked with a woman who worked for the bank. They were working together there. They had some connection there with the. I take that back. I got that story mixed up. I think it was at another job she had. Anyway, she had contact with this woman. She found out that she was a member of the church at some place. Member of the church. She also found out she was living with her boyfriend. Now, they hoped to get married one day. They planned to get married. But here's a young man and woman chatting up together, members of the church, and have not a bit of shame about it because they just apparently don't get the message that fornication is a sin. Our world certainly doesn't recognize that. There are movies that are pumped and promoted, and they always have the hero and the heroine, and they're sleeping together, or whatever, or they're in love. They don't call it fornication. They call it love. It's lovely. Love is so lovely. You know what Paul said about it? He said it's ugly and it's degrading for two people to use one another who do not have a right to one another. To mate with someone that is not your mate. It is a lie with your whole mind. He said, do not doubt this, that those who do so will not inherit the kingdom of God. And for those who are Christians, he said it is equivalent to taking the temple of God and joining it to a harlot. Those are words that are plain enough. Do not be, he says, deceived by the thinking of those who claim that, you know, sexual desire is, well, it's just like the desire for food. If you get hungry, eat. Well, it is a desire that God gave. There's nothing that is shameful about sexual desire. God did make us with sexual desire. And he also gave us that vehicle through which it might be expressed. And that is when you have two people who are joined together and thus they joined together physically. But outside of that, it's just nothing more holy than using somebody. And it's degrading. And it's immoral. And frankly, the fruits of it are bankrupting the country, spiritually and financially. That's another subject. But you want to know why it is that the treasury is dry. A lot of it is because they're trying to pick up the tab for children that are made outside of families. And those children that grow up on the streets and whose mentors are criminals instead of a father, and as a result, create the destruction they create. It absolutely destroys the fabric of a society. And as I've already alluded, it's not unknown in the church. It's not unknown in good families, where there has not been the carefulness that there ought to be in avoiding the sin. There's another passage that I think of when I think of this subject, and it's found in the Old Testament. Turn with me, if you would, for a moment over to the book of Proverbs. Long ago, the wise man addressed the fight for purity, and especially the danger to those who are younger. Look with me in Proverbs chapter 6, and let's begin with verse 20, if we might. The wise man wrote, "My son, keep thy father's commandment, and forsake not the law of thy mother. Bind them continually upon thine heart. Tie them about thy neck. When thou goest, it shall lead thee. When thou sleepest, it shall keep thee. When thou awakest, it shall talk with thee. For the commandment is a lamp, and the law is light, and the reproofs of instruction are the way of life." The very first point that he makes has to do with a young person taking the instruction of their father and mother and tying it, if you will, around their neck, binding it to them, keeping it with them. We need parents who will speak to their children and warn them about proper conduct and about setting boundaries. Young people, they don't have experience. They don't see the danger. They think they're in control. They don't understand. And that's why we as parents need to inform them, and we need to help them by giving them instruction, giving them limits. And a wise young person is not going to look at that as old-fashioned and resent that as restrictive, but is going to appreciate the fact that a parent knows better. They've lived longer. They've been down the road. They understand. And things that you might think of as being too restrictive or unnecessary, there's a reason why a good parent sets those limits. The wise man said, if you are wise, you'll take them and you'll tie them about your neck, if you will. You'll carry them with you wherever you go, because there is a constant danger. It's everywhere. It's at school, it's at work, it's in the church. We referred this morning to 1 Timothy chapter 5. In that passage, Paul instructs us not only how we're to deal with those who are older, but even those who are our peers. And one thing that Paul gave to Timothy was this instruction: you treat the young women as sisters with all purity. Make it your ambition to be pure and treat your fellow Christian, your sister, as pure. There are some things that are accepted by society and as a result by some of us that are not pure. You know, is it an old-fashioned rule to say that we need one per chair? We don't need folks sitting in each other's lap. Is it old fashioned to say that there are times when a chaperone is needed? Because you ought not be laying on each other. You don't need to have the boy and the girl run up to the bedroom and close the door. Just common sense. Oh, we're not to make any difference. We're talking about our ambition being purity. What we need are young women who are raised to be ladies. And a lady knows how to put her foot down and be treated like a lady. And a young man who is a gentleman will respect her and will treat her with the kind of manner that would suggest that he is all about purity. If that kills the fun wasn't worth having. He goes on in this passage. In verse 23, the commandment is a lamp, and the law of God is a light, and the reproofs of instruction are the way of life. The ruse and the carefulness that the world would roll its eyes at and think of as being out of date and unnecessary is the very instruction that the wise man said would give life. Some people think that all of these sexual warnings and the context here is passé to them. Have you ever heard somebody argue that it's really good for young people to live together before they're married? Just live together. Move in with each other, because that will cut down the divorce rate. That's some logic, isn't it? They say, oh yes, you see, that way you can tell if you're compatible or not, and so we'll have fewer divorces if more people commit fornication. You know, speaking to that point in particular, there's another article in the paper a few years ago. Let me tell you, the Birmingham paper is not written by Christians. And the articles here don't have some religious slant. But they had a survey in which they did find this fact. The couples who live together, that is, live together before marriage, are 46% more likely to divorce than those who don't. There may be a lot of reasons for that, but that's what they found. So much for that idea. You know, before I read that article, I knew it wasn't a good idea. You know how I knew it? Same way you do, because it's not what God recommended. You know, the Lord is not about trying to set rules for us that will trip us up and hurt us and make us send us backwards. There's something that Moses wrote back in Deuteronomy chapter 6. It's a passage that's always been a point of emphasis in my mind. I remember Irvin Lee years ago. Some of you might remember Brother Lee. He came to hold a meeting where I grew up. And he made this point. He said, I have not had a new Bible, over the last 40 years, he said, that I did not, when I got it, underline Deuteronomy 6:24. I was sitting there and I was thinking, I wonder what that says. I need to go look that up. So, I did. And this is what it says. The Lord commanded us to do these statutes, to fear the Lord our God for our good always. You know why the Lord tells us not to commit fornication? It's for our good. He does not want us to suffer the consequences that come from it. He's got something better in mind for you. Trust Him. Believe Him. Understand that the world is lost and doesn't have a clue. Their morality will destroy you. It will lessen you. But if you make up your mind to be pure and to let the Bible be your guide, you'll be happier now and happier certainly in the world to come.
The law, as the writer of Proverbs said, the law is a light. It's a lamp. And it will guide our path if we'll only let it. Let me go back there for a moment to Proverbs chapter 6. Because it's in verse 24 that he focuses on that from which we ought to be restrained. The way of reproof is an instruction to keep us from the evil woman, from the flattery of the tongue of the foreign or strange woman. Lust not after her beauty in thine heart, neither let her take thee with her eyelids. For by means of a whorish woman a man is brought to a piece of bread, and the adulteress will hunt for the precious life. You stop to consider how people get in some of the messes that they get in. And I have no doubt that there are sometimes when those who are younger, sometimes those who are older, without any evil intention, they just are not careful. And so they run through one stop sign and another, and before they know it, they're involved in a relationship that is wicked and destructive and that has done a great deal of damage. They didn't start out intending to do that. They just were not careful. But I also believe, and I believe this passage refers to it, that there are some people that by no means have innocent intentions. There are those who hunt. I know we got some hunters in this audience in terms they like to hunt deer or hunt turkey or hunt whatever kind of game it is. And you know that a hunter doesn't just walk out in the woods with no purpose and step on a squirrel. You know, he's got a plan. He's trying to find a way to be deceptive. He wants to trick that animal out so he can get him. When I was growing up, one of the jobs I had as a kid, I worked at the local park service for the park board. Had fun jobs like getting the wasp nest out from under the football field and all that kind of good stuff. Anyway, the man who ran the park board was a married man. But he wasn't married to his first wife. His first wife was a good woman by all accounts. But they had some children at home and she was, you know, she was tired sometimes. She was taking care of those children. And this fella, he liked to play tennis and he was a very active fella. And he had a secretary. And you know, that secretary was always available if they wanted to go play tennis or they wanted to go here or go there. I don't think there's much doubt that that woman saw what she could do, saw that she could take that man, and she did. And it's been my experience that if a woman sets her designs on a man, there's something about my gender, and I hate to say it, there's something about my gender that's too weak. And there are a lot of times when if she sets her mind that she'll get what she's looking for. Now that works the other way too. I need to be fair. You've got some, as the world would call it, some good little church girl. And here's the captain of the football team who takes a liking to her and talks to her and manipulates her and gets her to compromise here and here and here until finally he takes her and then goes about and brags to his friends about what he's done. You know, that didn't happen back then. Somebody hunted.
And the sad part, the person who was being hunted was too blind, too dull to understand. We can't be that. That's why this warning is here. Understand that they are those who are hunting, and you're the prey.
He asked this question in verse 27, back in Proverbs 6. Can a man take fire into his bosom and his clothes not be burned? Can one go upon hot coals and his feet not be burned? So is he that goes to his neighbor's wife. Whoso toucheth her shall not be innocent. You know, men don't despise a thief if he steals to satisfy his soul when he's hungry. But if he be found, he shall restore sevenfold. He shall give all the substance of his house. But whoever commits adultery with a woman lacks understanding. He that does it destroys his own soul. A wound and dishonor will he get. His reproach will not be wiped away. For jealousy is the rage of a man. And he will not spare in the day of vengeance. He will not regard any ransom. Neither will he rest content, though thou givest many gifts. You reap, he says, what you sow. A wound, a dishonor. What does the 22nd chapter tell us? You know, that a good name is rather to be chosen. You can lose that name. You can lose that name, just like that. Lose your reputation. Hurt people that you love. All for a moment's pleasure. For a short period of time in which this indiscretion, this sinful behavior is indulged. I can't help but reflect as I read those words about how that, you know, a man will, he will be hard on a fellow that steals bread. What will he do with a man who steals his wife? I could take you, I think I could, I think I remember how to get there, I could take you to the cemetery. And you have in this cemetery, among the head markers there, a bronze plaque. It has the man's name on it. And probably a couple of things you'd notice about that plaque. It looks like all the rest, except the fellow didn't live very long. He died a young man. You might wonder, well, did he die from disease? Was he in a car wreck? No. No. It says there on the bottom of the plaque, beloved brother. He must not have been married. Oh, he's married. He was married and married again, had children, and he had another woman who was somebody else's wife. I could take you to the spot. Parking lot of a strip mall where the car was the day that he and this woman, this other man's wife, were sitting in the car together. They had a relationship for some time when the husband pulled up and he pulled out a pistol and he emptied that pistol out. He died right there on the pavement. That's not a once upon a time story. That happened. And it was when he was buried, it wasn't his kids that were little that buried him, and it wasn't his wife or his other wife. It sure wasn't this woman he was committing fornication with, adultery with. It was his brother. And that's why the marker says, beloved brother. You think that story has been repeated over and over again? Anybody knew about that? He will not take a ransom. He will not spare in the day of vengeance. People don't realize the price sometimes they're going to pay, not only now, but in the world to come. What is it he said there? Whoever touches her lacks sense. Continue the thought in chapter 7, if you would, please. My son, keep my words, lay hold upon my commandment. Keep my commandments and live. My law is the apple of thine eye. Bind them about thy fingers. Write them upon the table of thine heart. Say to wisdom, thou art my sister. Call understanding thy kinswoman, that they may keep thee from the strange woman, from the stranger that flatters with her words. You ask the question, how is it possible that sometimes, let's just say, a man would put himself in a position that he does, that he would take up with somebody else's wife, that he would cheat on his own? Well, how can that happen? Oh, well, this woman can talk to him. You don't know how mean he is to me. Nobody understands me like you do. Blah, 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 blah. And so she sings this song. And he believes it. He believes it because he wants to believe it. It's amazing what a man will do. You're there to be flattered. It's amazing what the praise of a woman, how that can motivate a man. It is amazing. In some cases, this case, his praise is empty flattery and it's deadly. Solomon looks through his window and he sees an example. He beheld among the simple ones, verse 7, I discerned among the youths a young man void of understanding. Passing through the street near her corner, he went the way to her house in the twilight, in the evening, in the black and dark night. You know, when you read that, the first question that comes to your mind is, what in the world is he doing there? As you continue the story, you realize this is a woman, a married woman, whose husband is not at home, and he's going to go over there alone at night. You're begging for trouble when you do that. You put yourself in that circumstance. Paul wrote, flee fornication. You flee fornication because the temptation is real. But here's a young man running through every stoplight, every restraint that good sense would put on him. It makes no sense to do what he's doing. There's just some places you don't need to be. A young person has no business alone with a member of the opposite sex up some lonely road somewhere in a parked car. Doesn't make sense. It does not. That circumstance is not going to breed holy thought. And you have to take your purity that seriously. To listen to the counsel of your parents. To guard your reputation. I had a situation happen to me one time. I was in a meeting in a place, and there was a young man, a bachelor, who was there, and didn't have my family with me, just us two in the house. And I was staying in the back of the house there, and I came out one day, and this young man, this young preacher, there were a couple of the neighborhood girls, I think they must have been young teenagers or mid-teenagers or something, they were not of the quality of the young women that you'd appreciate. These were silly young girls. And they were in there with this young man sitting in his living room. And I, you know, of course that was a problem for a lot of reasons, one of which I was in there. I didn't like that idea at all, so I went outside, and then I called him outside. And I said, what in the world are your neighbors thinking when they see these two young women coming in your house? We're not thinking. I don't think this young man had any evil motive, but you just don't do things that are going to call your name into question. Much less put you in situations where you might be accused. You have to be smarter than that. But this young man, he's just making his way over there, telling himself whatever kind of lie a man tells himself in that situation. Heading to this house. And boy, what a winner she is. In verse 10, and behold, there met him a woman with the attire of a harlot, subtle of heart, loud and stubborn. Her feet abide not in her house. Now she is it without, now in the street, she lies in wait at every corner.
The attire of the heart. What do you suppose that means? She had on a long dress with a neck this high. That's what the attire of the heart would be, you reckon? He didn't have to spell that out for us, does he? Whether a woman is a harlot or not, she can dress like one. She can by the garments that are so short or so low cut or so tight that they leave nothing to the imagination. She can promote a message whether she intends to or not, and this woman certainly did intend to. It does not promote purity and does not suggest character of a godly woman on her part. She is dressed like a harlot, and she is loud and stubborn. So, when does the appealing part start? This is the thing that I find strange. I had a nephew, and he was not a member of the church. And he was trying to tell me one time about this girlfriend he thought he'd get serious about. And he said, oh, among other things, he said, she's got a cute little temper. You know, boy, you marry that temper, you're going to be sorry. It's going to be a whole lot less cute. Proverbs 31 is a passage that says, who can find a virtuous woman? Does it ever cross your mind to ask the question, who's looking for one? Who's looking for one? And the same could be said about young women. I want a bad boy that I can turn around, you know, I just, okay. And he, I know he's great sometimes and hangs out with me, but he'll change all that for me. Okay. Give me a break. Please. You're not that stupid. Beg for trouble. And we get it. Set your standards higher. Don't be impressed with what impresses the world. Think about things that are nobler, better. Make up your mind that you want the best. And make up your mind that you intend to live in such a way as to be worthy of that kind of part. You'll find a lot happier life now and later. But this young man, so verse 13, with, you know, in accord with her nature, she meets this young man and she catches him and she kisses him. Bold, brazen, unrestrained, shameless. You know, a daddy, when he's talking to his son, who's getting ready to date, I used to joke with my girls a little that their dating age would be 40. So, when the son gets around 40, he wants to think about dating. But really, though, when he's ready to make that step, he has this conversation with his son. He says, son, if you're dating, begins to say things that are off color, or hinting at suggestions, or behaving in such a way that sets off an alarm in your mind. You must do this. You must remember this way. I think I need to take you home now. And take her home. Get her out of the car. Don't let her back in. And to the young woman, if that kind of talk or that kind of behavior goes on, before the age of the cell phone, you used to tell your daughter, tell that date, I need to stop over here at this store. You get out and call your daddy. And don't get back in the car with him. I'll pick you up there yet. Let him go take his cell phone. You just cut that off right now. You demand to be treated like a lady. You be a gentleman who will not accept any less than a lady. And let Let other folks do what they do, but you won't be sorry. You will not be sorry. This young man wishes he had.
She catches him and she kisses him. And then she says in verse 14, I've made my peace offerings. I have my peace offerings with me, rather. I've paid my vows. It's amazing how people, as I said earlier, can divorce religion from morality. So that the young couple that my daughter encountered can be singing the same song we're singing tonight in an assembly and then go home and live together. She said, diligently I came forth to meet thee. I have sought your face. I have found you. And then she just propositions it. I decked my bed with coverings of tapestry, carved works, fine linen of Egypt. I have perfumed my bed with myrrh and aloe and cinnamon. Come, let us take our fill of love until the morning. Let us solace ourselves with love. She says, all the good men is not at home. My husband's gone on a long journey. He's taking a bag of money with him. He won't be coming back till it's all spent. What's she saying there? Nobody will catch us. Nobody will know. That's always the promise the devil makes. Go ahead and sin and nobody has to find out. You know. And the person you're with knows and God knows. And I promise you there's a day that will come that everybody's going to know. It's easier to get forgiveness than get permission. That is a lie. There's always the hard payment of regret that comes with sin. Every time. No matter what sin we're talking about. But this young man is not that wise. Verse 21 says, with her much fair speech she caused him to yield. And with the flattering of her lips, she forced him. She forced him. What do you make of that expression?
Well, she didn't grab him in a headlock, you know, and throw him down on the ground. That's not how she forced him. She flattered him. She buttered him up. She told him what he wanted to hear. And she led him along, as he goes on to say,
led him along like an ox to the slaughter, verse 22. Like a fool to the correction stocks, till a dart strike through his liver, as a bird hastens to the snare and knows not that it's for his life. It's like you take an old cow and put a rope around its neck and take it down to the slaughterhouse. Oh, that's used to being, you know, having a rope maybe put around it and carried here and there.
She's on his last trip. She doesn't know it. There she goes.
And so it is with this young man. Heading to destruction, blindly, stupidly. Verse 26 is also significant when he writes, she hath cast down many wounded. Many strong men, he says, have been slain by her. Her house is the way to hell, going down to the chambers of death. How many strong men have been slain by her? I stuck this little article in the folder here. This is an article that was a part of a church bulletin. The fellow had a rather elaborate bulletin. He had articles that looked more like a magazine. He had one article, a regular article, on the days of youth. And he had a young preacher to write this article for him. This particular article centered on dating, dangers, and guidelines. And I won't read the article to you, but I'll read just a couple of sentences. Keep thyself pure is one of the best guidelines to keep in mind while dating. If a young Christian, is willing to keep himself pure, he will never do what is unbecoming of a Christian. This principle is overlooked by many people today and is probably the major downfall of young people. It's good advice. It's a good article. But every time I read that article, what I think about is the fact that that young man cheated on his wife,
lost his wife, lost his family, lost his reputation, lost everything. It's one thing for me to stand up here and say it, but it's up to all of us to live it. And I trust that in this audience, there wouldn't be any of us who think, well, this is a lesson for somebody else. I don't need this lesson because I'm stronger than that. Let me tell you, Paul wrote to Timothy, keep thyself pure. He wrote to Timothy that he is to avoid the sinful fleshly lusts. None of us would think ourselves stronger than he. It's not just a lesson for men. It's not just a lesson for women. It's a lesson for all of us. Flee fornication. Not news to this audience, but I hope this reminder will help us to remember this simple fact that sin, as the fellow said, always takes us farther than we intended to go, keeps us longer than we intended to stay, and costs us more than we intended to pay. And that's right. Please get out your songbooks and turn to the number that's been selected. If it's your desire this afternoon to become a Christian, to leave sin and its guilt behind, to be buried in baptism and raised to walk in newness of life, we encourage you to let us know and we'll assist you. If you're here as one who is a child of God, has not been faithful to the Lord that loves you so, make it right with Him. And let us help you right now, please, while we stand, while we sing.